Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 3rd, and I'm your host, Kara Santamaria. And I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. That's my model, and I'm sticking with it. And the way that I can make that happen and still, you know, pay my editor and my assistant and not starve is A, from ad sales. You'll always hear ads read throughout the show. And B, from support by listeners just like you. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can just go to patreon.com/talknerdy and you can pledge your support on an episodic basis. This week, I want to thank our top supporter, Rob Schreck. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, along with Phil T-Bear, the Zombie Drubber, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. If you want to hear your name shouted out on the show, you've just got to pledge $25 or more per episode. But I also want to thank the hundreds of people who support the show at all levels. Okay, guys, this week, it's a great one. I say that every week, and I mean it every week, but I especially mean it this week because we get to sit down with Dr. Adam Rutherford. He is a geneticist. He is a frequent contributor to The Guardian. He is obviously an author, and we're going to talk about his new book. And he also presents BBC Radio 4's Inside Science. But we are going to focus today heavily on his new book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. It actually came out about a year ago. So when I say new, I mean relatively new. But that means that it is available everywhere that books are sold and you can pick it up. You should pick it up right now. So guys, without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Adam Rutherford. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. It's nice to be here.
So I am really excited to talk about your new book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. So, you know, genetics, genomics, CRISPR, genotypes, phenotypes, proteomes, all these good things. You hear these terms thrown around a lot in sort of popular science writing. I think a lot of people don't really know deep down what these things mean, how we define them. And I guess maybe I think it would be cool to start early, kind of at the most, maybe not early, but reductionistically at a low level. Uh-huh. Like maybe we start with DNA, with kind of this nucleic acid. What is it? What does it do? And why is it so important to this story?
Yeah, okay. So I am, one of the things I talk about in the book is that I'm almost pathologically allergic to definitions. and I go to some length to justify why this is important within science, within the specific context. And I think it's in the first chapter.
Why being allergic is important or why definitions?
Why definition?
Important?
Why I'm allergic to definitions and why I reject them in as often as I can. But, and it's a sort of complex and nuanced argument, which I sort of half believe, but you've asked a question to get me to define a bunch of stuff. DNA, we can do. I can define DNA.
Yes, DNA, I feel like we need to do in order to have the main conversation.
Yeah, sure.
And DNA is not that, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a very controversial definition, is it?
No, DNA is a molecule. It's a bit of chemistry, so it's a particular molecule. In fact, it's a long string of molecules that repeat, and each one of the elements, the repeating elements, there are four different units that repeat, and over the course of the course of a long string of a molecule, which can be millions of these units long. Now, the important thing about DNA, so everyone knows about the DNA having the famous double helix structure, so the beautiful sort of twisted helix, always to the right, and it's double because it has two strands to it, so it's like a ladder that you've twisted round to the right. And that's a good way of thinking about what DNA actually looks like. And that's the famous Crick and Watson paper from 1953. Now, the reason the structure is important, the reason we talk about DNA in the double helix, is because the structure is actually inherent to its function. And so those letters, those elements that make up the rungs, each one of the elements that is repeated millions of times across a DNA molecule, we refer to them as letters or more technically nucleotides. And they do something which is important structurally, which is Four of them are called A, T, C, and G. And A pairs up with T and C pairs up with G. And what that means is that on one strand of the DNA molecule, where you've got an A, you know you've got a T on the other side. Where you've got a C, you know you've got a G on the other side. Now, this is quite boring biochemistry so early on in our conversation, but it's so important because that means that if you take one double helix and split it in two, then you can replace the missing strand perfectly because you know every time there's an A on one strand, you should have a T on the other one. Now, the reason that's important is because that is what happens every single time a cell divides and all the DNA in a cell is reproduced perfectly so that the cell, the daughter cell, has exactly the same DNA as the parent cell. And every cell that has ever divided since 3.9 billion years ago has gone through this process. And so that the ability to replicate DNA is just the most fundamental aspect of all biology for all life on Earth. So the biochemistry, the sort of slightly nitty-gritty molecular, biochemistry nature of DNA is so fundamentally important to just the study of inheritance, because it's that molecule which gets replicated every time a cell divides.
And of course, there we're talking about cell division, meaning mitosis. We're talking about just a single cell dividing into two cells. We're not talking about the special reduction division process of meiosis, where you actually reduce your chromosome number by half.
That's right.
Through
That's right.
sex.
So almost every cell in our body is not a sexual cell. So they're called somatic cells. Yeah. And while we're growing from a single fertilized egg up into an embryo, into a baby, or when any sort of repair goes on, if you cut yourself and you grow new tissue to repair that cut, then that is the process of mitosis. So cells that already exist divide and produce another cell, which is effectively identical to the one that they've come from. And like I said, that is a process that has been going on for close to 4 billion years. And it's a perfectly unbroken chain as well that goes back 4 billion years. So
cool.
Yeah, it is cool, isn't it? So if you do cut yourself and you grow a new bit of skin to heal it up, that the new cells that are in that cut have a direct lineage via, uncountable numbers of cells, but a direct lineage which can be traced back to the origin of life itself. And that's one of the reasons why we know that all life is on a single tree, that all life forms on Earth alive today or that have ever existed are linked on one single tree of life. All those cells have had DNA and proteins and the same metabolism and all the sort of basics of biochemistry that enable life to exist.
And I think that's a really interesting and really kind of awe-inspiring thought when you really start to think about the fact that, the cells that made up who we are, the individual cell that eventually divided and divided and divided to make up who I am, half of that genetic material came from my mother. Half of that genetic material came from my father. But it's not just information. It's physical, matter. It's a physical piece of something that then divided to become who I am. And that physical piece of something was once in my mother and my father. And that physical piece of something was once in their mother and their father, and eventually was in a completely different species. And before that was in a completely different species. Like, there's physical matter that's being passed on, not just information.
Yeah, that is true. The DNA is produced in your parents' gametes, which are their sex cells. One of the things that I mentioned in the book, which I think is just a very small but cool factoid, is that, men produce sperm all through their lives, and they are generated quite close to the point where they're used. Whereas women are born with all of their eggs in place, and they're frozen in a particular bit of the cell cycle. But what that means is that the egg cell that became you existed in your grandmother when she was carrying your mother. And I just love that. I love that idea that there is a direct physical link between grandparents on the maternal side, which is that your grandmother had the egg that became you inside her before your mother was born. It's just one of those nice little factoids that I like pondering.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it is truly incredible that we now have the tools. You know, we don't just have to think about these things theoretically, but we now have the tools to trace back these lineages. And so I'm interested in your take, because I know you talk about this quite a bit, not just in your book, but in some of your writings and in some of the speaking that you've done. I'm interested in your take on these more, how should I say it, commercial, or these more democratic ways that people can learn about their lineage.
Yeah, I think it's slightly ironic that as someone who has spent their life dedicated to studying genetics, and there's been this, you know, massive explosion in our knowledge of genetics in the last 10, 15 years, largely because of the Human Genome Project, but also just the way knowledge and science progresses. And that has enabled the access to looking at our DNA and trying to understand it. It has been completely, not democratized, but it's available direct to consumers. And literally yes. Millions of people have taken these tests now. And on the one hand, that's super cool. You know, that's so exciting that people can do that. But the strange thing and the irony about being a geneticist is that I'm extremely skeptical about the usefulness of the information contained within those tests. And so genetics is it's merely the study of, well, families and sex and inheritance. That's basically what genetics is. It's the formal science of family, sex, and inheritance. And we think about these things all the time because they're sort of culturally embedded in us. And we've been thinking about family, sex, and inheritance for, you know, 10,000, 50,000 years, as long as we've been humans. But we've only really been studying it at a molecular level for the last 10 or 20. And so one of the things that I'm critical of these, so they're called DTC, direct-to-consumer genetic tests, is that the strength of the actual test is we hope, unimpeachable, is correct. The data you get back is correct. What I think is questionable and I'm skeptical about is how you interpret that data and the significance of interpreting that data. So, for example, the most popular form of this is ancestry testing. And something like 5 million people have taken a 23andMe test. It's something like, I think it's a similar sort of number for Ancestry.com. And then there's a couple of other companies that are also, you know, in the millions for people who've tried to, have paid money, spat in a tube and sent it off, and they get back a report based on their DNA of their ancestry. And it's kind of, you know, it's fascinating and it's fun. Genealogy is the number one pastime in America. And it's the number two pastime in the UK. See if you can guess what number one is.
Cricket.
I love that you suggested that. That's my number one pastime. Unfortunately, it's less popular than it used to be.
Oh, I'm trying to think of things that are quintessentially British. Number one pastime. I don't know. What would it be?
It's gardening.
Gardening, of course. I bet you that's up there on the list in the US too. It's probably in the top 15. I'm it might sure. not be in the top five, but oh, how fun.
I'm sure.
Oh, both of those things are
anyway,
just lovely.
Anyway, the point. Very enjoyable ways to spend a day. But the thing is, there's a couple of things worth mentioning about these genetic genealogy tests, which is where my skepticism is based.
And sorry to interject, but to be clear, you're talking specifically about the side of, let's say, 23andMe that is looking at lineage, that's looking at waves out of, you know, African migration, that's looking at what percentage of your DNA is represented by different locales. You're not talking about the medical health side of the test.
No, that's exactly right. So I'm just talking about what's known as genetic genealogy. So tracing family trees and ancestry using genetics rather than traditional forms of genealogy, which is like, you know, looking at births, deaths, and marriages and paper trails and things like that.
Sure. Which, as we know, are not always going to be 100% accurate when the lens of the time doesn't allow for, let's say, extramarital affairs or blending families within different races. Things are probably written down a little bit different than they actually took place.
Absolutely. And also most people's records peter out. And the only people we really know about in deep history are royalty because they were royals.
I was reading the other day in Rebecca Solnit's Men Explain Things to Me, and it's a very feminist kind of collection of, yeah, it's like the source of the term mansplaining. I was studying up for a paper I'm writing, and she made the point that a lot of early genealogy only has men in it. that the women just aren't even part of the conversation, which is, you know, leaving out half of the population.
Well, that is very true. And in fact, genetic genealogy has significantly changed that, because although it's still very difficult to identify individual people or individual women, because the records simply don't exist. Mm-hmm. And also the complexities of that historically, at least in the West, wives have taken their husbands' surnames.
Yes, and therefore, which is complicated.
Yeah. It does complicate matters. But there are pieces of DNA, there's mitochondrial DNA it's called, which are only inherited on the maternal line. And that has somewhat changed the understanding of matrilineage in a way which I think is generally positive. Anyway, we're getting sidetracked. The point is that, like I said, there's a couple of things. The first is that there isn't actually a scientific way of determining where your ancestors came from, where your DNA came from in the past. I mean, that just doesn't exist. And so what those tests are actually doing is they're using a database of living people, extant people, who have submitted their own samples, and then comparing your sample with living people today, which are geographically spread around the world. Now, what this effectively means is it's a proxy for where your ancestors are or were, based on the grounds that people mostly don't move very much over evolutionary time or over generational time. But it's worth noting that there is no scientific method for establishing where your DNA has come from in the past, only where your DNA can be found today.
Which is problematic for when it comes to mass migration events, which hopefully we have some of those things recorded, but some of them may not be.
Well, America is the most interesting example of that, for the very fact that it is a young country and that 98% of the population of America are derived from families that didn't exist there before 1492. And so...
yeah.
And that is further complicated by the fact that a significant proportion of Americans cannot trace their ancestry back to Africa from where they were enslaved, because records were never kept and they were forcibly migrated over several hundred years during slavery. So the most recent genetic genealogy tests for America center around European and Hispanic populations. And even terms like Hispanic are, you know, we say that very casually and we sort of know what we mean when we say Hispanic. But in fact, that's an enormously complicated sort of population structure within the people that we casually refer to as Hispanic.
And exactly the same way. It's European, it's Native American, it's also Black. Like you have these African migrations, you had slavery. There's a lot of, you know, those terms that used to be popular, which now we kind of don't use as much because they have a really negative connotation tied to them. But mestizo or mulatto, or they all mean something very different for South American and Central American groups of people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, one of the things that is not very recognized very well in the history of colonialization and the Americas is that, in fact, thousands of people who were indigenous to Central America, to Mesoamerica, migrated back on ships to Europe. Here's a fun game, because I'm not testing you because in order to embarrass you, because I can only do one here. But see how many indigenous Americans, including South American and Mesoamericans, that you can name that migrated from the Americas to Europe.
Like famous people or like friends of mine?
In history.
Oh, in history.
Not just your buddies. I mean, like people
from
history.
I'm sure everybody says like Pocahontas or something like that. Is that where they usually go?
That is the only one that people say.
Of course, if they even can remember her.
Yeah.
Did Sacagawea ever come over?
Not as far as I know.
Yeah, I don't think so. But. It's really, you're right. It's super interesting that like we don't even know about these massive migration events.
No, and there were like 10,000 of them.
Yeah.
Who went across in the 16th and 17th centuries or in the years after landfall from 1492.
Were these mostly slaves? Were they like enslaved women, wives?
Some of them curiosities, some of them just part of the traffic. Where, you know, Columbus turned up, and when he made landfall, the Taino, which is now in Hispaniola, they didn't take any men with them. They only took men with them, the opposite. They didn't take any women
with them.
Much
more common. Yes, yes.
Right. Yeah. And within 24 hours, many of the sailors from the first ship had raped local women. Mm. And some of them became pregnant. And as soon as they were there, as soon as Europeans touched Mesoamerica, the Caribbean, genetic information from Europeans had started to flow into the population of the indigenous Americas, which had been isolated from the people of the rest of the world for the previous 24,000 years, yeah. With one exception, which is when the Vikings, with Leif Erikson and the Vikings turned up in about the year 1000 of the current era. But we don't think that the Leif Erikson or the Vikings left any genetic trace. We don't think they bred with the locals there at all. In fact, they only lasted 3 years and were chased away because they were too fearsome. I love the fact that the people that we now think of as the Thule, but you know, Inuits and native Northern Americans. Yeah, the Vikings turned up and they were like, God, these guys are really tough. We're out of
here. I love it.
They got chased away after, the story is they got chased away after an incident when a Viking bull got loose. And the Skraeling, which is the Viking name for the indigenous people of the what is now Canada, we think it's like Newfoundland, Labrador. They were so incensed by this rampaging Viking bull that they basically skirmished and chased the Vikings away. You know, Vikings, supremely tough people from history, famously hardcore. And they're like, yeah, we've had enough of this. We're out of here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, good for the Inuit or you know, I'm not sure what the, you said the Viking name for them was, what did they call it?
Skraeling.
Skraeling. Yeah, good for them.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked again because these are
I know, because it's fun.
Such great stories. Yeah.
I know.
So anyway, the point is that about when we go back to genetic genealogy testing is that although there are sort of broad, large scale continental, not divisions, but gradations of what DNA looks like in different populations of people. And they are somewhat static over time. They're not particularly informative for understanding the deep roots of migration or theoretically. So I mentioned that I'm half Indian. So my mother was Indian, which means that my 23andMe, my dad's from Yorkshire, northeast of England. Mm-hmm. So when my 23andMe comes back, I'm 50% of my DNA looks like Northern European and 50% of my DNA looks like Indian. So, you know, I looked at that.
As expected.
Well, that was 100 quid well spent.
Yeah.
But theoretically, and I make this point in the book, and it's a reductio ad absurdum argument, but theoretically, if the entire population of India moved to India 9 months before my birthday, my actual birthday in 1975, then my genetic map would look exactly the same as it does today. And yet it wouldn't reflect any sort of population history of India in any sort of way. So anyway.
Oh, that's fascinating. You know, because I think about my own 23andMe, which I have done, and I come across mostly European, but mostly Southern European. My mother is Puerto Rican and my father is, you know, a Texan who I think two generations back emigrated from Italy, his great grandfather. No, actually his father. So yeah, my grandfather was Italian and my mother's mother, my abuelita, is Puerto Rican, but we are very like white, like racially, if you were to use that distinction, we look quite white. And part of that is because we're from the Canary Islands. Like this was a common immigration event to Puerto Rico. And we don't have within my personal lineage a lot of kind of Native American.
Oh, that's
DNA.
Fascinating. I've never met anyone, I've never met an American who can trace their lineage to the Canaries. That's
in Puerto Rico. Like but you have to know these things culturally as well.
Yeah.
And you have to know that other side of the genealogy, right? The non-genetic side, but the kind of the record keeping side of things to understand why it is that I'm so Iberian and I'm so North African, according to my DNA.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now, that's absolutely fascinating. I love that. Like I said, I've never, you know, in doing this book and in writing about these things over many years, I meet a lot of people who tell me their stories. Mm-hmm. And they're always fascinating because these family histories are just the connection with people in your past is really important. And to look at the migration and the transmission of that information through the generations around the world is just that they're the best stories we have. But that kind of brings me to my second skepticism about genealogy testing. And this is much more a sort of philosophical point about the way we talk about inheritance and how in the last few years, genetics and the study of DNA has contributed to that conversation in a way which I think is not necessarily helpful. And it's sort of about identity, and it's about identity politics, and it's about how you identify what culture or what tribe or what sports team you associate with, because those are the things that give us our cultural identity. Now, I don't think genetics says much about that. But I think the prevalence of these new genetic tests bolsters a view that it is, that there is a sort of essentialism to our DNA, which says, well, my 23andMe or my ancestry DNA test comes back and it says, well, you know, I'm 58% Irish or 48% Ashkenazi Jew or whatever. And somehow that says something about who you are. Now, yeah. I don't think DNA does say much about who you are. And I don't think it particularly in that it doesn't really reflect behavioral patterns over more than a few generations.
Absolutely. So, no. I mean, case in point, my boyfriend is 99.8% Ashkenazi and he knows nothing about Judaism. He is like the most atheistic. He's so not Jewish in any way, shape, or form. But his genes would tell you otherwise.
So I did a event in the Jewish Museum in London, which is a fantastic museum in Camden. And this was last year, and it was with a guy who's called Robert Winston, who's a very prominent senior scientist in the UK, a biologist and doctor, and he's pretty strict Jewish. I'm not sure he's Orthodox. I'm not quite sure of the definition, how he would identify, but he's culturally Jewish.
Yeah.
And we sat on stage and said these things and we agree with each other because we both have genetics in our background academically. And we were talking about how, you know, what is the meaning of the percentage of DNA that identifies as being Jewish or specific types of within Jews, like Ashkenazi, which is the biggest subset. And me as a non-Jewish person, and him as a fairly Orthodox Jewish person, was saying that we didn't think genetics was particularly important. And then we asked the audience, which was, you know, it was 200 or 300 people, and the majority of them were Jewish. Mm-hmm. And there was a brilliant 50-50 divide. We just got them to vote. Who thinks that there is a genetic component to Jewishness? And half the hands went up. And who thinks that it is not important, or that Jewishness is culturally important? And the other half of the audience put their hands up.
It also makes you wonder, if you polled the ones who put their hands up, how many are Ashkenazi and how many are Sephardic? Because the Ashkenazi kind of tradition has this genetic component, or at least we talk about it in that way. 23andMe tests for it, but there is no such thing as a Sephardic genetic component. It just means that you're from the sort of North African, Middle Eastern, Spanish, Iberian kind of area, you know? Yeah. So maybe you have different, like a different phenotype. You might have different traits. You might look slightly different, but there's no way to say, oh, that person is Sephardic, because the Jewish kind of genotype, quote unquote, isn't there.
That's right. And even Ashkenazi it's not a term which is free from scientific problems, because it is the largest group of Jews around the world. And that, because of the history of Jews and various diasporas and so forth, and persecution over many, many centuries, means that Jewish people have a particularly interesting migratory pattern from a scientific point of view.
And it's well recorded too. Like it is, good it records. Is.
And so, you know, what is the origin of Ashkenazi Jewishness? Well, it's a European phenomenon primarily, and then from the Middle Ages onwards, and then you see the various spreads of people of Jews around Europe and then around the world, and then they come back together. And it just goes back to the same point that we were talking about a minute ago about the historical trajectories of people, which are that our ancestry is always messy. And no one ever has stayed within one group of people. And our DNA reflects that. And I give a trivial example in the book, but which is not unimportant, but does relate to Jewishness. So my stepmother, who raised me, who's been my mother all my life, is from the east coast of England. She's mm-hmm. blonde hair, blue eyes, and white skinned. And she's a Catholic because her father was a Catholic. So my grandpa Jack, and he was an orphan. So raised by a Catholic school in Liverpool, mm-hmm. Sisters of Mercy. And so Catholicism is totally built into our family. Now, he was an orphan because we only knew the name of his father, which was John Adams.
It's a very common name.
right. And of course, his name wasn't John Adams at all. His naturalized British name was John Adams. So we found this out just a couple of years ago when we did some old school genealogy, not genetic genealogy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, his name was Josef Abrahamson. And he had migrated from an Orthodox Jew from Russia who'd migrated to Britain to Liverpool, famous port in the 19th century, naturalized. And overnight, his Jewishness is erased from history because his cultural identity becomes entirely dependent on what his name was. And he leaves children who are born British, born Catholic because they were born into a
culture, a society. Yeah. I mean, this happens all the time through acculturation. I mean, we have so many famous stories of that in about Ellis Island. My boyfriend's last name is Lewis, but it wasn't Lewis. It was Lewiskovich. That was his name. You know what I mean? But that happened to so many people.
I give two examples in just a footnote in the book, which is I've got a friend whose surname is G-E-E. And I've got a friend whose name, his surname is K-A-Y. And they have slightly different reasons for their names being like that. They're both from Jewish families. One was migrated out of Germany in the 1930s when they saw things going south. And I forget what his name was, but it was a long Polish Jewish sounding name beginning with G. Immigration officials just decided that, I'm not going to spell that. So they wrote G down. And that's his name. And K was the opposite. It was deciding that maybe having a very Jewish sounding name in 1930s England might identify them as being emigrants from Poland in this case. And therefore, and again, overnight you go from being Kreuzberg to being K. And it's potentially lost. So as a geneticist, the point to all of this is that as a geneticist, I think that there is much more cultural heritage. The significance of the software, which is our culture for humans, rather than the hardware, which is our DNA. I think we exist on hardware platforms, which are undeniable, but the software, which is our culture, I think are much more important in determining our identity. And whilst DNA can reveal all sorts of things that maybe were unknown, or that were mysterious, or they can reinforce ideas or knock down ideas of one's own deep ancestry. What it means for you yourself, I think is, low level significance. I get 20 emails a week from people saying, "Am I descended from Vikings?"
As if that gives them special powers.
Well, no one ever wants to discover that they were descended from, some other totally uncool people from history.
Well, I think about the fact that I came, ultimately from the Canary, not ultimately, ultimately we all came from Africa, but at some point from the Canary Islands. Why were there white people in the Canary Islands, 200, 300 years ago? Like, there's a reason for this. And so it's not something I'm proud of, but it's also not something I had any control over.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. So, but I am glad that you say it the way that you say it, because I don't think that we should be erasing our cultural heritage. We should be celebrating our cultural heritage and trying to understand our cultural heritage. But for the same reason that on census forms, and I don't think it's a perfect system, I think we need to improve, there's a question about race and there's a question about ethnicity. And ethnicity is really culture. It's really who you identify with, what is the language that you speak? Who are the people, what are the religious and cultural customs that you celebrate. And race really is a construct, right? I mean, at least I come from psychology and neuroscience. That's my background. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty well established that race is meaningless. It, like, it's exactly what we've been talking about here, but it's not meaningless for the person who lives every day with a specific skin color and it receives the experience of, you know, oppression or a lack of privilege because of that skin color. So it's not something I think we should ignore. I think it's something that we should really pay attention to, but moving towards a future where we understand that there's nothing genetically embedded within that race other than skin color. That's so the only real thing we can get out of it.
I completely agree with that.
Yeah, it's a more enlightened view. But to ignore skin color is basically to wash away the lived experience of millions of people. And that's also not the direction we should be going.
So I couldn't agree more with that. And I think one of my motivations for writing, at least part of the book, there's a very long chapter on the history of race and genetic scientific racism in the middle of the book. And part of my motivation for that was, me and you have this conversation, you can say that what you just said, and I can say I completely agree with you. What you've just said is entirely non-controversial within the scientific world, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as a public communicator about genetics, as I do a lot, I found myself experiencing a massive disconnect between this type of conversation I can have with you and standing in front of audiences where they're asking sincere, I'm not talking about racists or white supremacists here. I'm talking about educated people who are interested in science, saying things which we haven't really thought are true in science for 20 or 30 years. And it was happening a lot. And I was thinking, you know, I'm not doing my job right here, because if people are still talking about scientifically important genetic differences between different groups of people that we casually identify as races.
Yeah.
And we have a problem here. Exactly as you said, a great example for Americans is that obviously there are black people in America, right? Yeah. There are millions of black people in America. And because of their skin color, we can say reasonably that they are more recently descended from people who were in Africa than people with light skin who are more recently descended from people in Europe, right? Non-controversial
Absolutely.
Things to say.
Yeah.
Genetically, black people in America, that isn't a meaningful grouping of people at all. Other than the genes that are responsible for the various shades of pigmentation, which are more likely to be on the dark side than if you're of recent European descent, they are more likely to be a genetically more diverse group, black people, than all Europeans, all Asians, South Asians, East Asians. Everyone in the rest of the world put together is a less genetically diverse group than black people in America.
Well,
so exactly
as
you said,
like so much of human history was in Africa. Like the bulk
yes, it
of
is.
Human
it's
history
exactly
took
that.
Place there.
That's exactly right. And in fact, only recently in the last 6 months or so, when doing genetics on various people in South Africa, not the country South Africa, but the south of Africa, that we actually find that there are individual tribes that have more genetic diversity within one tribe than in the rest of the world put together. The reason is, as you allude to, most human history occurred within Africa, and the proportion of people that left Africa in the diaspora, the out of Africa events that populated the rest of the world, may well have been very few people. You know, a few thousands, the size of a small town or a small village. And so the genetic diversity of the people that populated the rest of the world was far, far lower than the people who remained in Africa for longer.
We're so inbred. Well, and the funny thing too, maybe not funny, that's the wrong word to use, the disappointing thing, you know, you mentioned two frustrations with this kind of new wave of genetic research, which is the second one was this idea of race being a meaningful construct beyond skin color. And the first one really had to do with, sorry, can you summarize again the first one? Because it was basically that it's based on extant data, not extinct data.
Yeah,
We're looking at modern. So, and I would add to that the third one is that the vast majority of the data in these databases comes from rich white people.
It absolutely
does.
Which is
really problematic, right?
It's really misrepresentative of...
I know, you can tell the difference between France and England in a 23andMe test, but all of Southeast Asia is one thing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's problematic.
So 50% of my DNA is yellow and represents 1.2 billion people in India.
Yeah, I mean, that's
crazy. And 50% of it can be divided up into 30 different hues of blues because they can identify bits that are from Scandinavia and Denmark and Northern Europe and blah, blah, blah. And that's because most of the people there have, well, most of the database is populated by people from Northern Europe. So it's a very, very important point that the Viking thing, I think, is really important here as well, because the truth of the matter is, this is something we don't think about well in ancestry, partly because the stories are good and we want to identify individuals from our ancestry because it's easy to tell stories, or it's easier to tell stories about individuals than it is groups of people. So if you can identify your great-great-great-grandmother who was from Lanzarote or Gran Canaria or whichever island it was, that's a better tale to tell people than a proportion of my ancestors were from islands off the coast of Africa, because it has more detail and more richness and we relate to people. But the truth of the matter is that every time we tell a story like that, we're telling a slight lie.
Yeah.
For very simple mathematical reasons, which is we have two parents, which means we have four grandparents, which means we have eight great-grandparents and 16 great-great-grandparents and 32. And every generation up, you double the number of ancestors you've got, right? Mm-hmm. And this is fundamentally a problem for doing family trees, because it means that the number of ancestors you have doubles every generation, which means that the number of ancestors you have goes up backwards through time. Now, we know that there are more people alive today than there ever have been in history at any point in history.
So insane to think about. How many is it? I was under the impression that the number was almost matched, that right now there were about as many people alive as there ever have been.
No. I'm sorry to correct that. No, I'm not sorry.
Okay. I appreciate it.
We like facts.
Yeah, seriously.
The best estimate is that the most scientific estimate is there have been 107 billion people that have ever lived.
Okay.
So, and there are currently 7-point-something billion people alive.
So we're not there yet. Okay.
But it's the wording of that is very specific. There are more people alive today than at any point in history.
That were alive at the same time. I see.
Exactly.
And so, but the number of dead bodies is 10 times or more than 10 times. What is that? You said there's seven. Yeah. So, but eventually there is this sweet spot, right, that people identify as, you know, if population goes in the direction it's going, there will be a point when there's as many dead people as there are living people, if that makes sense, which would be bad and very dangerous. And we may not have the carrying capacity for that.
Well, I think that's just the plot of the Dawn of the Dead, isn't it?
Exactly. 1-to-1, and maybe we can win the war.
I don't think it ended well in that film.
No.
I forget the details. Anyway.
But yes, there are definitely more people alive right now than ever. I mean, gosh, like when we talk about human history, especially pre-agrarian human history, we're talking there were only what, like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people alive at any given time, maybe millions?
Yeah, probably into the millions by that point. And then when we switch from broadly hunter-gatherers to agricultural economies, the number absolutely shoots up. It rockets. Mm-hmm. But the key thing here is that there is a mathematical conundrum in what we're talking about. There are more people alive today than at any point in history. But if you just count your ancestors, the number goes up through history, right? And if you go back to the tenths, the example I use because it gives a neat number, is that you, Cara Santa Maria, have around about a trillion ancestors by the year 1000. Okay,
that's
so there should
bananas.
Be. If you know, well, yeah, but it has to be true because everyone has had two parents through time.
Yeah.
But it also can't be true because there have never been a trillion people.
Yeah.
Right. So, but the answer is kind of obvious, which is that as you go back through time, positions on your family tree get occupied by the same people multiple times. And we're not talking about like dangerous inbreeding. We're not talking about like first cousins or marrying your sister or anything like that. It's just that the nature of our family tree spreads out from you and spreads out two by two for a few generations. And then it begins to collapse in on itself and fewer people occupy multiple positions on everyone's family tree. But what this we've calculated how these numbers actually work. And genetics backs this up now. The first calculations were done at the turn of the century, of the 20th to the 21st century. And the genetics now completely backs this up, which is that there's this concept, which is bit screwy, you know, sort of fries your noodle a little bit, but it's called the iso point, right?
Okay.
And the iso point is the time in history when all people who are alive then, who have ancestors who are alive today, those people at that time, at the iso point, therefore the ancestors of everyone alive today.
Yes, these were the genetic Adams and Eves, if you want to call them that.
So they're all the lines of all family trees cross through all people at the iso point.
Gotcha.
Now, when we calculate the genetic iso point for the population of Europe, the answer comes out as the 10th century, the 10th century AD, current era.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So 1,000 years ago. So what that means is...
Wow.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's completely like mind
that, like, blows your mind. Yeah.
Mind boggling. So we think that around 80% of the population of Europe had children that have descendants that are still alive today. And 20% of the population at that time, their lineage has petered out at some point. But what that means is that 80% of the population of Europe in the year, you know, 1000 or whenever, literally and absolutely and not metaphorically, or conceptually, they are literally your ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that every European shares all of their ancestry only 1,000 years ago.
Well, and I mean, it kind of, it blows your mind, but it also makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
Like, even when you look at, if you've done 23andMe, there's that portion where you can say, sure, I want to see if I have any, like, siblings, you know? And it usually it'll say zero people on 23andMe are your direct relatives. Mm-hmm. Zero people are your, you know, 1 degree off relatives. And 5,000 people are 2 degrees or 3 degrees. I mean, it's like the number proportionally just shoots up as you get multiple degrees away for that very reason. Because
really good point, that.
Yeah.
It's a really good point, that because I want to say something positive about the robustness and the significance of genetic ancestry as well. Mm-hmm. DNA is a really, really good at telling very close family relationships. And we've known that to do with for 20 or 30 years for forensics, but
for paternity testing, of course.
Exactly. And you know, even more so to these days when a particular generation of post-war, often people who were adopted or don't know who their fathers were because of the Second World War. And they're now at an age where they're interested in tracing their ancestry using DNA. And these are incredibly effective ways. DNA is an incredibly effective way of doing that. But the significance and the robustness of DNA as a test for post-family ties drops off a relative cliff after about third cousins.
And that would be why you have thousands of third cousins on 23andMe.
Exactly. Yeah. If it comes up with a second cousin or a first cousin, well, that's a story. Right,
yeah.
That's someone you never met before, and it turns out they're a first cousin. Well, you know, call me up, and we'll talk about that on the radio because that's a good story. but if it's one of the 57 people who identify as your third to fifth cousin, the reason for that is because you've told me already that you're relatively light skinned and you're from the Canary Islands, which means like you have European ancestry in the
I'm kind of like a light olive. Like I can pass for Latina when I tell people I'm Latina. They're like, okay, I see it. But also if I told them I'm, you know, Northern European, they'd be like, okay, I see it.
Yeah. Well, we're probably fourth cousins, me and you.
Yeah. Right.
You know, almost certainly or fourth or fifth. Where, you know, if we had perfect family trees for both of our families, there'd be a cross point within the last 200 years.
How funny. That's so strange. I mean, but it's not. It makes perfect sense, but it's so strange.
But it's so strange because we don't think, you go back five generations or six generations, and you've got 2 to the power of that number ancestors. Mm-hmm. And whereas we talk about our great-great, I've already done it, we talk about our great-great-great-grandfather being a repatriated Orthodox Russian Jew, when in fact he's one of 32 people who are equally related to me. Like, actually, he wasn't related to me genetically because he's my on my step lineage. But if he were, probably. And so when you look at, if you could do a perfect family tree for everyone, it just becomes unmanageable after a few generations because there are so many people in it.
And that's why, you know, we're so used to thinking of ourselves as the trunk, but really we are that, that branch on a branch on a branch on a branch. And so if we think of that beautiful picture of the branching bush that is not just human genetic history, but all of, you know, living things, like all of life on Earth, the trunk of the tree is sturdy and strong and it feeds everything else. We are just one terminal point on the branch, but we tend, because we're so anthropocentric and we're so narcissistic in our views, to think of ourselves as the central, and then we go back. And that's
this
just
is true.
We have to flip that, right? We have to flip our perspective.
Well, do you know, I tentatively suggest that we need to retire the metaphor of evolutionary trees.
Even though there's a tree on the cover of your book.
It's more like a leaf.
You're right. It's a leaf. It has the same structure, though.
No, it is. It is still a useful metaphor. But this is where our conversation started.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank a new sponsor this week, Calm. And I have to say, I'm super excited to be partnering with Calm, the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. It was even named Apple's 2017 App of the Year. And the reason I'm excited to be partnering with them on the show is I already use Calm and have for like the last 9 months. I love it. I use it every single day. And that's because it has tons of guided meditation practices to help you relax, to help you work on things like anxiety and stress, and, you know, to really take that time for yourself to breathe, to become centered, and really work on self-care. Now, the way it works is it has tons of different guided meditation options within the app. There are 7-day programs, there are longer programs, and there are one-offs. And as you improve, you know, it's really great for people who are super scared to meditate. You know, I don't know what I'm going to find when I start going inside of myself, or I don't really know how to do it. My mind keeps wandering. Meditation is a practice. It's a journey, as everybody says. And if you don't know how to do it, or you're a little scared to do it, I think Calm is perfect. That's why I like it, because it helps you get started when you're not really sure. But as you continue on and you decide maybe you want less guidance and more kind of introspective or quiet meditation, there are plenty of options for that as well. There's also a brand new meditation each day called the Daily Calm. And something else that I love, sleep stories. They're like bedtime stories for grownups. You know, if you have a hard time falling asleep at night, it can really help you. There's also sleep meditations that help you, you know, relax your muscles, kind of down your body in order to get more restful sleep. And my favorite part too is that there's music within the app, and it's divided by sleep music, focus music, music for having a little bit more energy. I actually listen to Calm all the time when I'm reading, because it's a great steady supply of relaxing music that doesn't distract me. So guys, for a limited time, you, the Talk Nerdy listener, can get 25% off of a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/nerdy. It includes unlimited access to all of Calm's amazing content. You can get started today. That's C-A-L-M, calm.com/nerdy. All right, let's get back to the show.
Definitions and these types of analogies or metaphors that we use to describe complex behavior and complex science or complex family histories, when they work brilliantly. And when they don't work at all. And in fact, the thing you were just saying about the trunk of the tree, at least for humans, I'm not sure it works there either, because it's not really a tree at all. What we now know from genetic evidence, that's after Homo sapiens migrated away from Africa and into Europe and Eurasia, we interbred with Neanderthals, who were traditionally and still are a separate species from Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
But Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis have a common ancestor about 600,000 years ago, and me and you carry Neanderthal DNA within us, which means that they successfully had offspring, cross-species offspring, which we carry the legacy of today. So that's a loop. It's a 600,000-year loop, admittedly, but that is definitely a loop. And we now know that we interbred with another type of human, the Denisovans, that we have no bones for, one finger bone and one tooth from Siberia. And we also know of another species of human or another type of human that we have no bones for, but can identify based on the fact that there's a sort of gap in our DNA, or at least comparing Homo sapiens DNA with Denisovan DNA with Neanderthal DNA, it doesn't quite add up perfectly. And there seems to be input from a human that we may have bones from that organism, that species, but we've never extracted DNA from it. So there's a phantom human ancestor in our genetics, in our genomes, which I just think is, you know, these are amazing stories. This is almost magical that we can identify humans for which we have no physical remains for based on the complexities of our genomes. But it does make me think that the tree might not be as useful as it once was. The latest evidence is emerging that we've always thought for the last half a century that East Africa around Kenya and Lake Turkana, mm-hmm. and places like that, this is the nursery of Homo sapiens. It's the richest place we have fossils from prehistoric ancestry dating back, you know, 3 million years, but also right up into 100,000 years ago. Well, we're now beginning to see the earliest Homo sapiens in Morocco 300,000 years ago, and a new model is emerging that actually we are more like a sort of gestalt Pan-African species that contains the legacy of many different types of anatomically modern humans that were dotted all around Africa.
And in fact, even out of Africa, right? We're starting to see, like, it's just every week I feel like there's a new anthropological discovery of, you know, tools found in China long before we thought that there were people, modern people in China. Yeah. Like, it's just everywhere. It feels like that these early migration events were much earlier than we thought.
Totally. You need to talk to my editor about this, because in the final stages of writing the book, basically, I'm pretty sure that anthropologists, paleoanthropologists were doing this just to piss me off.
Oh, for sure they were. They were like, I know that he's up against a deadline.
But you need to talk to my editors about this, because like, I'd sign off the final copy. That's it. I'm not putting any more references. Okay, there's a paper coming out on Wednesday, which has to be in the book or else it's going to be out of date.
But see, this is good. This just means that you get to do second and third editions, which is always something you want as a writer.
Yes. I'm going to be rewriting this book for many years to come.
Oh, for sure. This book, and that's the cool thing, right? A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived will continue to be rewritten because we'll never have all of the information, because that's just not how fossilization works. And that's also super interesting.
It is. And also, it's one of the things that I've always done in all of my work, which is to try and talk about the reality of how science is and also how human history is, which is that it's messy and complicated and nuanced. And the simple stories are nice, but they tend not to be very true. And I think we just need to be better at reveling in the complexity rather than saying, you know, here's the thing that made us human, or we're an East African species, these are the first humans. Because every time we scratch the surface, every time we look properly, we just go, huh, well, that turned out to be way more complicated than anyone anticipated. And I think we just ought to be better at reveling and celebrating the beauty of the complexity, because as humans, we crave narrative satisfaction, but human history never delivers on that. So that's something I've written into all of my work, and my new book, which is out in the UK in September, but won't be out in the States for another 9 months after that, is a sort of a sequel to A Brief History in that it picks up the story within the last sort of 50,000 years, and it's much more about cultural evolution. And again, it's the same story in that centuries people and to this day lots of scientists and popular science writers want to tell the story. This is the thing that made us human, right? It was art or speech.
It was language. It was exactly.
Or, you know,
philosophy.
Or consciousness or something like that. And it's never one thing. And when people say it's one thing, you can guarantee that they've just got a book to sell.
But your book has them all, right?
Well, it's all of these things. And we're really bad at saying it's one thing and it's not this thing and it is this thing. This thing was so important. Here's an example, which I like talking about. In the last couple of years, a new theory has emerged called the pyrophilic ape, right? So pyrophilic meaning fire loving. Mm-hmm. And chimps on the savannah in Fongoli, they patrol fire. They're very used to fire because there's a season, there's a fire season. And they behave in ways which are incredibly sophisticated with regards to fire. They can sort of anticipate how it's going to spark, when it's going to spread, how toxic it is. They will go into places that have burnt, that have stopped burning. They will go in seconds later when they know it's safe, and they'll forage for food because it's been cooked.
Oh, that's genius.
It's super cool. And yeah, they do this behavior, and it's like, well, that's been recorded over the last couple of years. It's relatively new. So it's an idea. Other species do something similar. Vervet monkeys do it. And fire is part of it, of our ecology. It's an important part of the ecology of the earth for life on it. And so the theory suddenly becomes, oh, maybe fire was the thing that made us who we are. And you go, oh, that's really cool, because we need fire. We are obligate fire users, modern humans. We can't operate without fire. And we may have been like that for 100,000 years. And so you go, well, these chimps in Fongoli are doing this. Maybe this was the thing. Yes, this is the thing.
It's one of the things.
Pyrophilic age. And you go, yeah, that's really cool. Except fire is really damaging for almost every other great ape on Earth. Yeah. And you don't get fires in Morocco, and you don't really get fires in East Africa or near Lake Turkana. Or, you know, when there's fires in Indonesia, the only thing that happens to great apes is that they die.
Right? Yeah.
And so it's, yes, really important. Maybe it was a great model for some type of pyrophilic apes, but almost all chimpanzees do not survive well in fires. They die as a result of fires. Almost all chimpanzees live in tropical foresty areas, which don't burn very well at all. And so anyway, the point is that every time we identify one thing, we think, hey, that's really, that is a great bit of science. That is a really interesting bit of science. And maybe that does, because we're anthropocentric, because we're self-obsessed, we think, oh, yeah, maybe that tells us about us. No, it doesn't. It tells you about Fongoli chimps.
Yeah, and it also just kind of goes to show like how narrow part of becoming expert in something, right? Part of getting a PhD and part of dedicating your life to something very specific is that your knowledge base becomes narrowed and you start to see everything through that lens, which can be really problematic. And sometimes you do have to take a step back. You know, I'm seeing this right now, exactly what you were talking about, this idea of what makes us human. There is a big movement of, it was probably psychedelic drugs. There's a massive movement of ethnobotanists right now who truly believe that consciousness flipped over from a more animalistic view to a more self-perceptive view when animals started experimenting with drugs, and we were able to force our brains into neural pruning patterns that we never could before. And maybe that's part of it, but it's not all of it, just like none of these things are all of it, because it's all of the things combined. And that algorithm is very hard for us to fathom. You know, that's the difficulty. And I think it also goes to show, you know, and I hate keeping you this long, but exactly what we were talking about earlier, we sort of brushed past a portion of the book that you dedicate to, which is this idea of kind of heredity used for bad in human history. And I'm reminded, I've brought this up on the show before, I'm reminded of being in a photo that I saw of a periodical room in a university, right? So we have, but I'm not sure if everybody listening, if you remember back, if you did go to college, that there's that room in the basement, usually in the basement, where all of the bound periodicals are in your library. And so it's every journal article, and they bind them up by year, and they have these brightly colored spines. And there's a photograph of the Annals of Human Genetics, which was started in 1925 by Carl Pearson, a known eugenicist. And back then it was called the Annals of Eugenics. And in 1953, the title switched over to the Annals of Human Genetics. And so you can see that 1953 bound copy right next to the 1954 copy, when all of a sudden it went from human genetics, or sorry, from eugenics to human genetics, because there was a sea change in perspective. This was no longer kosher. This was no longer okay to do in the academic arena.
Absolutely. So,
and the truth, I mean, this was a fundamental part of scholarship, was trying to prove that Black people were inferior. This is what a lot of psychology was founded on. It's what the IQ tests were founded on. It's what these statistical tests, Pearson and Spearman and Jensen, who, by the way, is still alive and is still writing this nonsense. It's what it was founded on. I mean, this is insanity to think about.
I have much to say on this subject, not least because I studied and still am at UCL, University College London. Mm-hmm. And Pearson and Spearman were there. Pearson was the second Galton professor after Francis Galton, who was the founder of eugenics.
Great guy.
And yeah. I got taught in the Galton Lecture Theatre, and there's a Galton professor to this day. And I'm three academic generations from Francis Galton, from being at UCL.
Wow.
And so the history of race, genetics, scientific racism is profoundly in my own academic DNA. And we spent a lot of time thinking about how we deal with this, because Galton was a truly, truly great scientist. I don't use this word very casually, but he was a genius, and I've got no doubt about just justifying that. And I feel I have to follow that immediately up by saying he was a profound racist and the founder of the eugenics movement. He gave us the word eugenics. Weirdly, just by chance, I guess, more than anything, the UK never had a eugenics policy. But the two countries that embraced it, other than the sort of deranged philosophy of the Nazis in the 1930s and the Holocaust, the two countries that embraced eugenics as a state policy most vigorously were Sweden and the United States.
Absolutely.
31
we have
states.
Massive like eugenic policies. Like people were sterilized. Yep. People of quote unquote low IQ in the United States were sterilized. I mean, talk about effing up the family tree.
Right. And in fact, and of course that affected people of low socioeconomic status more. It affected more disproportionately
people of
affected
color,
women, people of color. And up until the 1970s. So we think that something like 70,000 people were involuntarily sterilized during the 20th century in the USA, up until the 1970s, where something like 2,000 Native American women were sterilized. And this is the 1970s. Yeah. And in fact, see if you can guess when and where the most recent involuntary sterilization of a woman carried out in the States was.
In the States? Oh, gosh. I mean, tell me it wasn't past that. Okay, I was born in 1983. I want to say it was before I was born. Please.
2010
no.
In California. California was the most vigorous adopter of eugenics policy in the whole of the states. Famously liberal.
So liberal.
I know. 31 states had official eugenics policies over the course of the 20th century. I believe Arizona was first. I might have got that wrong.
Sounds about right.
But California was the one that went for it. Most.
And where was and that in the prison system? Like what?
Yeah.
How did,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Okay. Yeah. That's common.
Recently within the prison system. And in fact,
disenfranchised people.
So these are what I think the reason we're having this conversation now, and the reason why I think we need to be having this conversation now, and it all ties up with the genetic testing that we were talking about earlier, the ancestry testing, is that I am arguing now that there is a re-emergence of scientific racism, and beginning to talk about ideas that are bolstered by a form of genetic essentialism and ideas of race that people within the genetics community, within the scientific community, within the psychology community put to bed. We thought we put them to bed 10, 20, 30 years ago so that we can have these conversations and just agree about race being a social construct with little scientific use. And more as politics have changed and genetics has become accessible to more and more people, and I think this has really only happened in the last 5 years, having been doing this kind of stuff and having these conversations for 20 years, I do think things have significantly changed and measurably changed. And we're trying to launch an academic project at UCL at the moment, trying to get funding in order to really try to put some numbers on this, because it's difficult to really get some robust data on it.
Yeah, because anecdotally it feels like it's changed. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, I do something which I really strongly recommend that no one does, which is that I haunt message boards on 4chan or white supremacy websites.
Oh, it's so scary. And I don't even feel like I have to do that because, like, for example, sorry to interject, but I just tweeted 2 days ago a quote from Beverly Tatum, who wrote a beautiful book in 1997 called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together at the Cafeteria? Or in the cafeteria. And the quote is such a genius, again, an analogy. It's not a perfect analogy, but it's such a good analogy. And it's about anti-racism. It's about the idea that white privilege exists, especially in American society. And even if you're passively, well, here, let me read it. I sometimes visualize the ongoing cycle of racism as a moving walkway at the airport. Active racist behavior is equivalent to walking fast on the conveyor belt. Passive racist behavior is equivalent to standing still on the walkway. No overt effort is being made, but the conveyor belt moves the bystanders along to the same direction as those who are actively walking. Some of the bystanders may feel the motion of the conveyor belt, see the active racists ahead of them, and choose to turn around. But unless they're walking actively in the opposite direction at a speed faster than the conveyor belt, unless they're actively anti-racist, they will find themselves carried along with the others. And the idea here is that white privilege happens to us all passively if we are white. And unless we work to be actively anti-racist, we see something, we say something, we push for better policies, unless that becomes part of our social view, we become activists for social justice, we are part of the problem because we're perpetuating this background noise of white privilege. And the comments on social media that I got in response to this post made me cry for humanity. So many white men arguing that they're not racist and I'm the racist for calling them racist.
Yeah.
I mean, it just blew my mind.
Yeah.
Especially in Trump's America. I mean, I have to say that, like, this has always been the case, but it's so bolstered that people can be out loud with it now. It's a very difficult time.
I think that's probably true. The thing I mentioned earlier about people writing to me saying that they're descended, asking if they're descended from Vikings or telling me they're descended from Vikings, you know, fine. Yes, you are because you're white, which means, and Vikings occurred before the genetic isopoint for Europe. So if you've got pale skin, you're descended from Vikings, you know,
yeah.
It's that's fun. That's kind of cool. But there at the other end of the spectrum, there is genuinely a pernicious movement within white supremacy, within active racists, within people who describe themselves as Nazis. And it overlaps with a sort of pseudoscientific loose grouping of people who refer to themselves as being interested in human biodiversity. And can you hear my my kids just woken up?
Oh, okay. We'll keep it short here at the end.
I think my wife might be going to deal with it. It's very hot here. Poor girl. You know, the trivial stuff is wanting to discover that you're descended from Vikings. And at the other end of the scale, it is trying to prove that you are ethnically white and therefore superior. And that is real. And those conversations are happening again in a way that I sometimes makes me furrow my brow and go, shit, I thought we'd got over that, but apparently not.
I mean, you're right, in the scientific community even, these are educated people, but definitely beyond that, there's a deep white nationalistic, white superiority, supremacy movement in America, but not just in America. We've seen it in, you know, picking back up in Germany. We've definitely seen it in France and Italy.
It's here in England.
Yeah.
It's ongoing. And people talk to me all the time about, and again, sometimes they're overt racists and sometimes they're not. They're sensible people and educated people. And they say things like, what about when they say, well, you know, the indigenous people of Britain or, you know, natives of Britain. And I, you know, without meaning to be patronizing or insulting, the question that you have to ask at that point is, well, when do you mean? I mean, do you mean like 50 years ago?
Yeah, it's much easier in the United States to talk about First Nations individuals.
Sure, right.
Like, we know the difference between indigenous, or in Australia to talk about Aboriginals, or Māori people in New Zealand. Like, we have an indigenous population.
Right, and the Māori is a really interesting example as well. For there's a very specific reason for that, which sorry to bang on about it, but is in the book, because...
Of course,
it's such an interesting example. My dad, although born in the northeast of England, his family migrated to New Zealand when he was 5, and he came back when he was 20. And we still have loads of family over there. So New Zealand has been a big part of my cultural history for all of my life. And of the stories of the indigenous people of New Zealand, one of the things that my dad used to say, and he is the least racist person on earth, he used to tell us, and this was part of my cultural understanding of New Zealand, he used to say that, well, of course, the Maoris weren't the indigenous people of New Zealand. They were the indigenous people of New Zealand were called the Maoriori. I pronounce that right?
Yeah, I think they say Māori.
Māori,
yeah, M-A-O-R-I. Yes.
No, that's Maori. There was a people before them, but the Maori.
How are they spelled?
It's M-O-R-O-R-I.
Oh, that's very confusing. Okay.
Yeah. And that the Maori.
Māori. Yeah.
Wiped them out.
Gotcha.
So they invaded, they wiped them out. Now, 2 years ago, I was in New Zealand meeting up with some colleagues, and I said this to a researcher, and she just laughed at me.
Oh no.
She laughed at me, and I said, why, you know, like, this is a story that my dad, who spent 20 years living in New Zealand, tells us, and it's in some of his old history books. And she says, yeah, well, that's what everyone who's age 60 thinks in New Zealand, because that's what we were taught at school. But the truth is that when we look at the origin of this story, it was fabricated, made up by British pseudo-historians with a specific intent of simply reinforcing the notion that Europeans arriving in New Zealand and having battles and conflict with the indigenous people, the Maori, it was just history recapitulating, because the Maori weren't indigenous there at all. The Maoris had done it themselves. And
that
therefore,
is bananas.
It's fine.
And of course, this is in an area where we often think of the best possible type. I mean, I hate to even say it. I don't want to use the word best, but when we think of colonial conflict, when we think of individuals coming over and taking over indigenous lands, we think of New Zealanders, because it happened so much later than a lot of other kind of colonial endeavors, as doing it a little bit more right, as like respecting, you know, the declaration was written by both the Māori and the settlers, but like even they fucked up left and right. You know what I mean?
That is not that specific language, but that's exactly what I say in the book. You know, New Zealand is held up as an example of one of the best, possibly the best example of the least damaging relationship between European colonializers and indigenous people. But just, you know, fascinating that the way the stories are told and the confidence with which those stories are told, and they filter down through the generations to me, and I say it to a New Zealander, and they just think, dude.
Yeah,
oh, just read some history.
And that's the thing. Their history, they've always been, I think always, but tried to do a very good job of writing history from the perspective. It's a very Howard Zinn in America model, right? The people's history, like writing from the perspective, not of those in power, but of those who were affected. And you see it within, I mean, you see the Māori, like, names for everything on buildings in New Zealand.
Yes.
Before you give a talk in New Zealand, you talk about how the place where you are and the land that you're standing on was occupied, or, you know, is the land of the indigenous people. There's like this honor that you give in public. And this is just part of the culture there. We have none of that in America.
Yeah, well, so I talk about that a little bit in the book, because in the chapter about the Americas, the relationship between Native Americans or First Nation peoples in Canada and geneticists is a profoundly toxic conversation at this point in history.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons, which are to do with some pretty bad behavior by scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And while one of the themes of that chapter of the Americas is when I was writing that chapter, which was specifically for the American publication, so the one that most of your listeners will have access to.
Yeah.
My editor was saying, listen, you can't just write a chapter which is basically saying, oh, and it turns out that American people have DNA too. Right, because you've talked about the history of Europe and the history of Britain very specifically, and migration around the world, but not talked about the Americas at all. And I don't want a chapter which says, "And Americans have DNA too." So here's the American story, and it isn't that. And the reason it's not that is because we don't know about the population structure of the Americas nearly as much as we could do or should do.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because of America's peculiar history of post-1492, of European colonizers. And the relationship between European settlers and Native Americans has been so, well, you know, genocidal, fractious, murderous, and
rapist,
and fairly appalling for five centuries. And even through the 20th century, when things are beginning to get better and people in power recognize that indigenous Americans have been mistreated and at the bottom of society. But then there's just a couple of events where scientists went into to ostensibly do something positive and work with tribes people to find out about migratory histories and other aspects that can be elucidated by genetics. And they behave badly, possibly, or clumsily footed, maybe not intentionally badly, but not respectfully. And so we talk about scientific engagement a lot, so engaging with indigenous peoples. And in some examples, it's sort of box-ticking exercises. You know, you engage by doing the right thing according to this protocol, which is not the same as being respectful or trying to understand a population's lived history, which makes for slower but richer science.
Absolutely. It's that emic versus that etic perspective. Like, how can I understand this through the eyes of the people who have lived here, not through my own perspective, you know, my own kind of colonial perspective. And right. That's something that I think anthropologists sort of started to get a little bit sooner. They still, you know, there's still a rich history of horrible colonialist anthropology, but they did kind of start to get it sooner because they do qualitative as opposed to quantitative research for the most part. And that allows for this.
This is true, and I think that it's very interesting that the history of anthropology, which in some ways branches off and becomes more sort of human genetics and migration and human history, all these things have shared roots, but the roots of anthropology are colonialism, and there is definitely a measurable trend within the history of anthropology, but also in the current history of genetic genealogy and looking at indigenous people, where there is no doubt a sense that you can parachute in, spend a couple of weeks, get the samples that you want, and there's your papers or there's your book deal, and you look
and
like you're being...
sometimes they never talk to the people.
They don't. And sometimes they can't. I'm not sort of naming names or pointing fingers here, but you come back and say, yeah, well, I was out there with the people of wherever, and we spent time with the people of wherever, and this is the science that we get out of the back end of it. And actually, what they've done is they've you know, I call it soft scientific colonialism. I don't think it's badly, you know, it's not malicious, but I don't think it's necessarily a way to get good science. But more importantly, it's short termist, because if you piss off the people that you're trying to understand the stories of, rather than allow those people to tell their own stories using the tools that they might not have available to them, but that we should work with them, then you get much richer stories. Here's an example, which I think is important. The whole history, the culture of European history is one of migration, right? So whatever stories you look at in the history of Europe, it involves moving people around, whether it is diasporas from biblical times from Israel, or it is the Vikings, or in Britain, it's, you know, being conquered several times by Vikings, by Anglo-Saxons, by Norman conquests. There is just a sort of continual movement of people through the ages. And so I think that one paper that I cite in the book suggests that this is part of our cultural narrative in such a way that it's normal for people of European descent to think about the movement of people over generational time.
Yeah.
Almost all Native American cultures, both in South America, Mesoamerica, and North America, almost all of them are very, very tied to the land, and their creation myths tend to suggest that they were born of the land.
Yeah.
Now, that means that culturally, cruising in and saying, well, you know what? That's your creation myth. Science says something different. We've got a reasonable model of how we think the Americas were populated, which is via what is now the Bering Straits, but was the Bering land bridge 20,000 years ago, and a population of people migrated into what is now Canada, sat there for probably 8,000 years, called the Beringian Standstill, and then when the ice has melted and thawed, they moved down both continents all the way to the tip of Tierra del Fuego. And those, that was the genetic pool from which the indigenous people of the Americas emerged. Incidentally, I need to credit my friend and colleague, Jennifer Raff at Kansas University, who's a big part of this research and influences me greatly on this. And she's writing a book about the history of the Americas, which she just started, so it's going to be a couple of years yet. But she's super cool and someone you should definitely talk to.
Absolutely.
So that's what science says now, and that is the scientifically true narrative, as we understand it, of the peopling of the Americas. But to cruise in and say, "Hey guys, give us your DNA, and we'll tell you where you actually come from."
Right? Yeah, they're like, "We know where we come from."
Yeah, yeah. Right? This is it's just sort of clumsily. Well, there are several examples. I'm not generalizing. I mustn't generalize too much because there are plenty of anthropologists and genetic anthropologists who are trying to do this right. But there are plenty of examples over the 20th century and into the 21st century where that's what we've done. We've cruised in and gone, "Hey, we can tell a really cool story about some of the peopling of the Americas. All we need is your blood."
And it's like, no.
Yeah. Well, in some cases,
that's also the thing. Yeah. It's like, why would you trust me?
Yes. And then you took it away and studied schizophrenia.
Yeah.
You didn't,
or
exactly,
then you infected us with, you know, whatever disease, like, name here. Like, we have such a deep history of this horrible. Oh, yeah. We've all got syphilis, yeah, and you're not giving us the treatment. You know, there's a lot of these issues here.
Not a healthy relationship. And
no,
so, you know,
I wouldn't trust the white scientists either.
We've got documented statements from the last 5 years of tribal leaders and national leaders saying science hasn't treated us well. You should avoid talking to geneticists because it hasn't been kind to us. Now, I hope it's beginning to change because we're having these conversations. And it's all very well me Skyping you from London and talking about the 20,000 years of history of a country that I love. I love America, but have no cultural deep understanding of what it is to be an indigenous American.
Nor do most Americans.
Sure. Yeah. And yet you can buy for $300 a direct-to-consumer genetic test that, if it pops up as being a bit Native American, for an extra $25, you can get a special certificate.
Oh, God. Yeah. And and here's the thing, like, what you're saying about genetics as a discipline, what we're saying about cultural anthropology as a discipline, I think it also holds true in my allied field. You know, so my background is neuroscience. I'm now getting a PhD in clinical psychology, but I also work in media, as do you. And I've done a lot of television shows, and National Geographic is near and dear to my heart. I do a show for National Geographic called Explorer. And just recently we were at the Television Critics Association talking about the new season that's coming out. And people were saying, how is this different than old seasons on Explorer, because it's the longest running documentary series on television here in America. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, we're not trying to be colonial assholes anymore. Like, the truth of the matter is, and I really am proud of National Geographic for putting out a magazine issue on race recently, where they talk deeply about our roots are not pure. You know, the history of exploration was a history of colonialism in a deep and kind of difficult way. And although we learned a lot, we made so many missteps that might even outweigh what we learned. And I think it's important that we recognize that. And I think it's important that when we start to, you know, we do documentaries now, that we're not making poverty porn, and that we're not, you know, going into these places observing through a Western lens and walking away and saying, "Oh, woe is these sad, sad savages," which is what we used to do. It's just, I think, unforgivable. And I'm really proud of the fact that there are movements in a better direction. And I think all these things do tie together.
Yeah, here's an interesting sort of little vignette which I came across, which is that now you can get these tests, which I think are, I'm not sure bogus is the right word, but the science behind them is not robust. But they claim, there are companies out there that claim they can ascribe tribal ancestry or tribal status using DNA. Now, my understanding is this is not possible currently because of the paucity of genetic data from indigenous people.
Yeah.
And I'll back that up by saying, I also think it'll never be possible because of the history of movement of people around the Americas, especially during the last 500 years.
Well, now, and the genocide, just the massive.
Okay, so this is where it gets really interesting, because in a terrible way, the take up for these tests has been proportionally low amongst indigenous people. And there may be a specific reason for this, which is that many of these cultures rely more heavily on an oral tradition than a written tradition. And because of the forced migration of people since European colonization, the forced migration of indigenous tribes, many people who identify as, Catawba or Sioux, because they've got several generations worth of those people and they're born there and then that's who they are, have a suspicion that they might not have been from those lands 200 years ago because of some piece of forced migration by settlers. And there's specific examples of this is 1830, when Andrew Jackson enacts the, I forget the precise name of it,
The migratory, whatever. What, the Trail of Tears, basically.
The Trail of Tears, right. The Trail of Tears. So several thousand people are moved from Dakota. Dakota people are moved from Dakota, thousands of whom die en route. And then they migrate, many to California. And whereupon they may take another tribal status or maybe integrate into another tribe. And at some point, just like my Jewish ancestors suddenly became Gentiles when they were raised in the Catholic orphanage, they're no longer Dakota, they're actually Sioux. Now, we think the uptake may be low because some of them think, in fact, incorrectly, that the genetic test may say, hey, your DNA is not Sioux, it's actually Dakota, and therefore you might lose reparation rights that are associated with those lands. So it's like a shit cake where
it
every
is
layer-
just across the board. Yeah, because not only could this fuck you from the government, it also could make you question your cultural heritage, which it shouldn't do, but unfortunately will probably. And then what happens if you find out that you're the product of rape? You know, how does that really tie in? What happens when you find out that, you know, you identified as overwhelmingly Native American, but you actually have quite a lot of European blood? Because this happened to plenty of people. I mean, squaring that circle is difficult when your entire culture is founded on these deep beliefs and traditions.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so we're only going to say the negative here because I do think it's getting better. And I think there's an example of it getting better because we are aware of these conversations, and there are geneticists within the indigenous American populations. There's people like Kim Tallbear, who's an amazing anthropologist stroke geneticist who writes brilliantly on this subject, and people like Jenny Raff, who's at Kansas, who are thinking about these types of things. And we're just aware of these conversations. 2 years ago at the ASHG, the American Society of Human Genetics, which is the big human genetics meeting where thousands of geneticists go, it was led by the ceremony was opened by a First Nations people. I think it was in Vancouver, by a First Nations people, and they, a bit like you were referring to for Maori in New Zealand, they opened with a ceremony from a First Nation people, passed the talking stick to the leader of the ASHG, and proceedings began. If that's gesture politics or performance, so be it. But at least we're beginning to have the conversation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it has to start somewhere. I fully agree. And that's, you can say what you want to say, but, you know, that's the way things need to be changing. And it should have always been that way. But, I mean, we've got to start somewhere. And
I'm an optimist. I think that there are blips on the arc of history. And maybe we're in a blip right now. But I also believe that the arc of history tends towards,
progress. Absolutely. I agree. And you know what? I think on that note, that's a really good time because I have kept you so much longer than I so apologize for keeping you for this long. But I close my episode each week by asking my guests the same two questions. And they are these kind of big picture questions. And you think about these big picture issues in your work all the time. And so I would love to hear your responses. One of them tends to be darker and one tends to be a little bit brighter. And those questions are that when you think about the future in whatever context is truly relevant to you. You know, whether we're talking about your work, whether we're talking about the future of, I don't know, humanity, society, the globe, the universe even. I talk to cosmologists all the time, so they have very big picture answers. The questions would be, one, what is the thing that you are most honestly concerned about? Like, you know, what's disconcerting? What are you very worried about? And maybe you think that you can't help but have a pessimistic outlook because you think maybe we're beyond a point of repair. But on the flip side of that, I want to know your genuine optimism, not lip service, but what do you actually think is something that we're moving in the right direction on, something that we really can look forward to?
Well, I am going to be optimistic about both. I can be optimistic in embracing both of these answers, because mm-hmm. I think that the optics of what feels like degradation, what feels like a cheapening of public discourse, but, and I'm referring specifically to science, although I obviously have politics of my own, and maybe they're quite close to the surface, as has been part of this conversation. But if I just focus on what the science is, it may sometimes look that there's, my God, there's a lot of bullshit out there. And whether it's, I don't know, Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop, Deepak Chopra and
eggs.
Quantum consciousness, or even Jordan Peterson and his non-existent understanding of evolution.
Or human rights, yeah.
Or those things, yes.
Those things.
I think that generally, though it feels probably amplified massively by social media, though it might feel sometimes like the battle is relentless and the next article comes along, or the next guru comes along, or the next million selling book, or, you know, movie of the week or whatever comes along, and you think, shit, man, this is like, I don't know how much longer I can keep fighting these battles. Yeah. And then you remember that it is the optics that change your focus, and that most people are interested and curious and not malevolent and interested in science and interesting in learning. Because I said earlier that I wasn't going to say the one thing. I refuse to say what the one thing that humans do that makes us human. But I do think there is a thing, and it is that we teach, and that cultural, in more scientific terms, cultural transmission and cultural accumulation are things that very few organisms do very sporadically, apart from humans, and we do it all the fucking time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We are definitely, even corvids, which do it, we have them beat.
Yeah, hands down. I mean, I am
hands down
super impressed by Caledonian crows every day, but you know what? Yeah. I can do everything that a Caledonian crow can do, and better.
Except fly, although we have flying machines, so there's that.
Okay, maybe not fly, but I'm really good at getting fat grubs out of logs with tools. I'm not. I've never done it before. But I imagine that I would be if I tried. Oh man, that's so arrogant species-wise, isn't it? Someone's going to challenge me to go up against Caledonian crow and fish grub.
Oh, this is going to be, I'm going to pitch this as a new television show.
Well, I want you to do me a small favor, which is that I need a photo, if you can, of that junction in your library.
Right.
Of where it goes from the European Journal of Human Genetics.
I'll see if I can find it. I lost my laptop quite a bit ago and lost all my images, but I think I can find it again on the internet. Yeah, yeah.
That's like super important for my research. I've got my next two books mapped out, and the Book of Humans you'll get in 2019, but the next one after that is going to be specifically on race.
And, it's so important. It's so, especially like we said, in this era of Jordan Peterson and this era even of, why am I blinking on it? Richard Dawkins, and this era of, like, you know, our leaders not being as careful, our scientific leaders in the media, the people that a lot of people look up to, especially on my side of things, which is, you know, I'm very, very active in the skeptic movement. You know, we've co-written a book. It's coming out in October, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, How to Know What's Really Real in a World Increasingly Full of Fake. And it's, you know, it's all about these things, these Gwyneth Paltrow debunking things. But within my kind of circle, I see people who just, you know, talk about identity politics. They think that we are in a post-racial society. They literally, they just ignore all culture and all human psychology for the sake of this very scientific viewpoint that is fundamental to everything, that there's no other type of epistemology. I mean, it's really dangerous. And so, and it's funny because I am an advocate of the scientific worldview. To me, it's what carries me through. I'm an atheist. I'm a, you know, I'm a scientific thinker. And yet, there are always limitations and these things have to happen in context. And I worry so much. Anyway, I'm starting a whole other conversation and I'm supposed to be letting you go.
My friend of mine who's a comedian who does a lot of science-based comedy in the UK called Robin Ince, who you might have come across.
Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah.
He's got a line which I love repeating, which is that when I have conversations like this, the accusation from certain parts of one's listenership or audience say, well, this is just your liberal bias shining through. And Robin's response to that is, well, you know, turns out that reality has a liberal bias. So deal with that.
Absolutely it does. And of course, as we said, the arc of human history is bending towards progress. And I would prefer to be on the right side of history as opposed to, you know, our nation's president right now, who is definitely existing on the wrong side of history. So, yeah, with that... Adam, a brief history of everyone who ever lived, the human story retold through our genes. Adam Rutherford, I'm going to have to get you back on the show when your next book comes out because I could talk to you for hours. This was so much fun.
Oh, I'd love to. It was a real pleasure talking to you, Cara.
Excellent. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.